Welcome to the Debate at GO8 podcast series, exploring issues and research affecting the Group of Eight universities and, by extension, Australia's economy and our society. My name's Ron Candelars. I'm a freelance journalist and producer. And throughout this series, we've been canvassing a range of topics touching upon the work of all the Group of Eight universities. They include the Australian National University, Monash University, UNSW Sydney, Universities of Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, Queensland, and Western Australia. Today, we'll be examining the ramifications of the recent federal election. With me in the pod booth studio is the GO8 CEO, Vicky Thompson. And joining us online is the Vice Chancellor of Sydney University, Professor Mark Scott. Mark is an accomplished communicator, and many of you will know of him from his 10-year stint as Managing Director of the ABC, where he led that organisation's transformation as a public broadcaster in the digital age. Well, firstly, a question to both of you. Your backgrounds have many similarities. You both worked at the ABC. You, Vicky, as a newsroom journo in Adelaide, and you, Mark, as managing director from 2006 to 2016. You both worked as advisors to government. Vicky, you were chief of staff to Premier John Olsen here in South Australia, and you, Mark, were chief of staff to two education ministers in the Greiner government. Given your experiences in government and journalism, what do you make of this most amazing recent election result? Firstly, to you, Mark Scott.
Yeah, I thought the election night coverage was tested because we'd never really seen anything quite like this before. Government losing a lot of seats, but they weren't migrating immediately across to the opposition. They're moving into this new political force emerging in the middle, the Teal independents, stronger Green presence in the lower house. So I think it's new, it's different. I think we haven't seen anything quite like it before, and it will take us a while to work out what it means. So I think it was a sweeping change, a profound change, and for organisations like GO8 universities and for the University of Sydney, we've now got to think back about how we constructively engage in this new operating environment. But, you know, I suppose I've been watching election results election nights for the best part of five decades, really, I guess, since being a precocious lad. And I'd never seen anything quite like the phenomenon that we saw on Saturday night.
It was quite incredible. And I should say I didn't scale the lofty heights of the ABC that Mark did, of course. I was a hack in the newsroom for many years with the ABC. I think it's really interesting the way that it was covered. I mean, if Anthony Green gets confused, you know things are a little confusing when I was watching the ABC coverage. But I think for us as a country too, it's also a time to pause and reflect and think about, you know, what is our sort of political paradigm now? And is this the start of a significant shift where we won't have the two major parties in the same way that we have previously? Certainly when I speak to younger, I'm talking sort of the 30 to 45-year-old demographic, they are just absolutely celebrating the fact that they've made a dent in what they see as a very traditional two-party system. So I think there's kind of the long game for us to have a look at. For universities, I think to pick up Mark's point, and certainly our chair said the same thing recently, you know, and we're very nothing if not frank on these podcasts, I think that I'm not expecting rivers of gold from the new government, but I do think that we'll have a constructive dialogue. And, you know, we've talked on this podcast previously, Ron, where the environment has been sometimes rather hostile towards universities over several years. And I mean, I'm not making a partisan comment necessarily, but it has been quite challenging. And you would hope that not just with the election of the government, but this rump of independents who are in the main professional, tertiary educated women. And certainly, you know, we made the point of reaching out to them before the election. They came back with very considered responses to the issues that we raised with them around university and university policy. I think it's a positive outcome for our university sector. So I'm really looking forward to the next few years and thinking about how we actually engage now with both the government and those independents.
It is just so clearly it feels like a reset, doesn't it? The result feels like they reset. And to a degree, that's why it's that much more interesting, I think, than, you know, government losing seats, opposition winning seats, new government being sworn in. You know that the government's engagement with that crossbench and the size of that crossbench is going to be very different to what we've seen before. And I think for many of those who interact with government, and universities are clearly one of those organisations, it's an opportunity for a reset for that dynamic as well. And I think we would be naive to think that it's simply a case of a change of government. I think it's much more complex and nuanced than that, and our engagement will need to be more nuanced as a result of the whole new setting that we have in Canberra.
Absolutely.
One of the things I wanted to put to both of you, though, is that technically you could get to a position where Labor, with a reduced majority, wins government in its own right and doesn't necessarily need the teal independence of the Greens. But to overlook them in this current climate would seem to me a very dangerous thing to do, given that the electorate has really expressed this desire for a third force.
And that's my point about, I think, the enthusiasm from, you know, a range of people, not just younger people. And you know, the very recently sworn in Prime Minister has said he wants to do it differently. So they're on track to get a majority, and perhaps by the time this is actually released, they'll have their majority. But I do think, and as Mark said, it behoves us to actually engage differently. But it also is the same for the government. They cannot ignore the fact that a third of the population in this country voted the way that they did. Mm. You know, we are a country of thirds at the moment, and I, you know, the jury is out, but I can't see that they would ignore that. And I don't think the Teal independents will allow themselves to be ignored, frankly.
Yeah.
Yeah, two other reasons. If they do get a majority in their own right, it'll be wafer thin. And the one thing you can see with how politics operates at a state and a federal level, it's not unusual for governments to lose a couple of seats for any one of a number of reasons during a term of government. And I think you can then expect that this government will want to start out with a respectful and engaged environment with that crossbench, because they may not precisely need them now, but in a year or 18 months' time, they may well. So I think they'd be smart, and I'm sure they will, assertively engage with them across a range of policy issues. The other thing I think that, and there's been some commentary about this immediately after the election, that if in fact that Teal Independent group is not just engaged around key issues, you know, climate change, gender, integrity, but there's also a sense of rejection of politics as usual. If the government doesn't engage with them substantively, then critical Labor seats being targeted by Teal Independents next time would not be an unrealistic proposition. So I think the game has changed. The government will want to substantively engage with them. And I think that makes for an interesting and focused policy development framework in the years ahead.
So you'd see this as a permanent paradigm shift, that we're looking at something more like European parliaments with multi-member coalitions.
Well, I just think that's a realistic proposition. And I think one of the things you can see is that there have been some independents who have been able to hold on to their seats for a considerable period of time, building on strong local constituencies. You know, there's an argument that says all politics is local, and you can see that there were strong local forces at play here with some of these independents who got up. So I just think that's a new reality, and to view it as an aberration and just a phenomenon that there was a rejection of this final term of the coalition government, I think that would be short-sighted and naive. And the more realistic proposition is, here is a new force that might reshape politics, and as a consequence, the government needs to substantively engage with them across a range of policy issues. That's what I'm expecting to see.
And the point you make about this, you know, everything being local to you, Vicky, I mean, it explains the incredible influx of women into the federal parliament on very, very local issues that were very important to them in their communities.
Absolutely. And a feeling, you know, I think that some people feeling disenfranchised by the current process and, you know, not being able to engage. So, look, I only see it as a positive thing. And as I said, I think it's exciting for organisations like universities and for me as chief executive of the Group of Eight to really think about how we engage and advocate, because we can't just keep doing business as usual. This is completely different. And I think that's actually exciting and an opportunity for us as a sector.
So to you, Mark, what does it mean for the higher education sector? I mean, Vicky talked before about this rather testy relationship with the the coalition previously. Do you see this as a time to maybe change the agenda?
I think it's a good opportunity for a reset and a bit of a fresh start. And I think we welcome that opportunity. I do think, you know, we're going to need to be careful in how we engage with government. I think you can already get a bit of a sense in the first days after the election that there's everyone with their agenda, every interest group, you know, every different sector ready to engage with the government on what the sector needs. And it almost ignores the fact that the government lands with a very, very complicated agenda in their own right. You know, they have what feels like full employment, but really a deep skill shortage. There are critical questions about the state of the global economy and the domestic economy and Australia's international competitiveness. Clearly, a very complex engagement with our major trading partner, and at the same time, enormous levels of debt incurred to get us through COVID and before that, and talk about fiscal recovery. And so I think just to be knocking on the door of politicians talking about what we need as a sector, well, you're going to find yourself in a very long queue of people with their log of claims and expectations around a new government. So I think, you know, part of our challenge is to be there in the solutions business for government, to think very carefully about the problems that government are trying to solve, the problems that government needs to engage in, and to bring the deep disciplinary expertise and capability, particularly of our research universities, to bear around those problems. So to be a partner with government in coming up with some very demanding solutions that are required across an array of policy areas, and for our contribution to the public good to be very clear through this work. And so I think, you know, there is a risk, I think, particularly for, you know, parts of the sectors or parts of the economy that have had a difficult time under the previous government to think, well, all is happy and right now. Well, I think that would be a little bit simplistic. And so I think we need to find the right ways to engage and substantively be seen to be partners and helping to provide solutions to some of the very clear issues the government's going to be facing in the years ahead.
You talk about being in the solutions business. Do you have some in mind that you think that GO8 universities in particular can really assist government? You know, rather than being a drain on government, another handout looking for cash, can be, in an alliance with government to resolve particular issues?
Well, I think if you look at the big issues that kind of came through and dominated the campaign, I mean, where we are with climate and the transition of our energy economy and the research that demands, clearly our universities are at the forefront of that level of research, which is truly complex and multidisciplinary and multifaceted. We are clearly very important partners around that research effort, but not just that research effort, the economic effort that's required for that level of transition. Again, areas like aged care, areas like mental health, the real expertise and policy expertise and understanding about bringing about changes that are required in those very, very important areas, that lies particularly in deep disciplinary research universities. So when government comes looking for solutions to the problems that they have, the experts, those who've studied the area for years, those who understand what works and what hasn't worked or how changes need to be met, they will be found within the universities. And so for us to partner with our great research universities about coming up with the policy solutions that are required, or to make the investment in the research that will be required to deliver those solutions, I mean, I think that's where we need to play ourselves. And so it's not simply a case of give us more money. There are great problems that the higher education sector faces in Australia, and we should anticipate a strong and substantive engagement in those areas with the new government. But on the problems that they face, the complexities that they face, we bring great expertise as well. And, you know, I suspect we are more likely to get solutions and engage around the problems we have as a sector when we are seen to be leaning in and helping government deal with the pressing issues that they face as they're sworn in, and the pressing issues that they face given what we've been through, given the debt we've incurred, and given the challenges that COVID has revealed exist in our community that we need to address now.
You agree, Vicky? I mean,
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Being part of the solution has always got to be our priority, not being the problem. And an investment will follow because we are part of that solution. And it was something that I said at the very beginning of the campaign, actually, as our positioning piece for the Group of Eight, that every single area, regardless of who was in government, at the, you know, government or opposition, every single area of the economy touches upon, we touch upon every single area of the economy. So if we're talking about skills shortages, we know there's an absolute crisis in the medical workforce. We know there's a massive skills shortage in the engineering workforce, for example. We are embarking on this huge defence sector. In fact, I've just been recently speaking to the new government people about that just in the last sort of 48 hours. They're going to be coming to us, asking us, you know, we need this expertise in, you know, these areas. And so the research side is absolutely critical for universities like us. And then, of course, there's the graduate side. And for our universities, you know, 110,000 people graduate every year from Group of Eight universities. They go into those jobs. We need a lot more. And so I think that's part of a discussion that we will definitely be having with this incoming government.
Mm. To you, Mark, I wanted to drill down into a few things about your personal career so we get away from some of the bigger picture things. But looking at you and yours was a bit of a baptism of fire. You came into the university sector, you know, at a very difficult time. You started your career as a teacher. You later moved into editorial roles at Fairfax and later to the managing director role at the ABC. You're now vice chancellor at Sydney University. What's been your favourite professional incarnation now? Or is that yet to come?
You can't ask.
Who's your favourite child?
No, I mean, look, I think, you know, I've been very fortunate in my career. I've been given wonderful opportunities. And I think in every one of those roles, they've been deeply absorbing and very engaging, quite challenging, and working with fabulous people. I think, you know, one of the, I suppose, characteristics of my career is that I've dealt with in large public-facing organisations, delivering services, I think, for public benefit and public good. That's one way of framing my career. Another way of framing my career is I run unmanageable organisations full of people who never want to be managed. You know, that's another element that I think is true.
But I did work at the ABC, so I do know what you're on about.
Sure. And like, I think there's some similarity between my great friends at the ABC and my new friends in the higher education sector. I think actually there are real similarities. I think a lot of our academics, our researchers, they're very passionate about their work. They want to get on with it. That's what I used to see with journalists and program makers at the ABC, sometimes a bit sceptical about the contribution that management might be making to enabling them to get on with their work. But they are complex institutions, and what you need to create is an ecosystem, an infrastructure around talented people that allow them to flourish and allow them to do their best work. And I think part of the role at the ABC and the role at the universities is to actually to speak on their behalf, to constantly speak up the value of contribution that they are making, and to clear space, in a sense, for them to be able to get on with their work, for them to be able to flourish in our environment so they can make the great public contribution that they want to be making.
To education, though, you started as a teacher, so you've obviously had a very passionate involvement with education for your entire career. What do you want to instill now in your role as Vice Chancellor at Sydney Uni?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think my career, there's the media and journalism side, but there is the education side. I was a teacher, I was a chief of staff to an education minister, I was education editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, and my most recent role running the New South Wales education system. That's one of the largest education systems in the world. No, I believe fundamentally in the transformational power of education in individuals' lives and in an aggregated sense, what an educated community brings in terms of opportunity and prosperity and transformations that can come on the back of education. I think the testimony of the new Prime Minister is so powerful about that. Housing Commission boy gets a place at the University of Sydney, takes advantage of all those opportunities and flourishes at the university and ends up as Prime Minister of the country. I think the transformational power of education, the ability of great education to overcome inequality, the power of education to open horizons and to transform individuals, I think, remains absolutely remarkable. And so I'm a strong believer in that. And I think at the University of Sydney, as we develop our new strategic plan over the next decade, you know, part of our challenge is to ensure that we identify all students who could flourish in our environment, irrespective of their background, irrespective of where they grew up, irrespective of the education levels in their family, and we find a way to get them to Sydney and to support them in Sydney so that they can take advantage of all the opportunities that Sydney has to offer.
Am I right that you've had seven prime ministers out of the University of Sydney?
Yeah, I think Prime Minister Albanese is number eight.
Right.
And, you know, and I think I'm really comforted by the fact of, you know, in a sense, how respectful and thoughtful he is of that transformational opportunity in his life. And we need to continue to be able to identify young men and women like him and provide them with the same opportunity that he had, and to think very carefully about what is the supporting infrastructure we need at the university to not just be able to attract students like that in, but to create an environment where they can flourish and take advantage of all the opportunities that should be on offer. And I think that's going to be a central piece of our strategy for the next decade.
Do you think that the university sector will have a better relationship with the likes of Albanese as Prime Minister than the testy relationship that it had with Morrison as Prime Minister?
Well, look, you know, I think we're all hopeful of a reset, frankly. I struggled to understand why there wasn't a deeper and more substantive engagement, particularly with the big, deep research universities. But with the previous government, I've said that publicly, our contribution around the identification of COVID, the response to COVID was absolutely vital. But still, there seemed to be kind of a narrow nitpicking of some of the failings of universities rather than an embracing of the scale of achievement of universities and the opportunities that universities offered. I don't expect, I must say, though, a straightforward engagement with the new government. I think they will have criticisms of how we operate. They will have challenges to decisions that we've made. You know, I think it will not necessarily be straightforward, but I do hope for an open and constructive and a fair-minded engagement. And I hope that we can get around the table and problem solve together. And that the starting point of that is a frank and open and respectful dialogue. I think that's where the sector is going to want to start. And that's fully what I expect from the Prime Minister and the senior leadership team that he will put in place, the cabinet he'll put in place, and conversations I've had with numbers of them over the last year or two. That's what they've signaled that they would want to bring, and that's what I expect we will see.
So we are recording this on the day that the Sydney University posted the Australian newspaper reported a significant boost in surplus. And of course, you're not Robinson Crusoe with that, I have to say. I think most of our GO8 universities are in the process of reporting similar surpluses and other universities. You and I both know that that is a challenging argument. We know that, we can explain a lot of that. But for the people who are listening and watching, how do we explain in collectively for the group of eight, you know, a several billion dollar surplus, when at the same time we know on the ground just how hard it's been over the last 2 years during COVID?
Well, I think if I look at the Sydney results, Vicky, they come in two parts. I mean, almost half of the amount that we reported has come from the increase in our investment portfolio. And just as people's superannuation increased last year, as the markets boomed, so the university's investment portfolio increased. We had generous support from our philanthropists, our financial donors and backers, and that's in the figures as well. And there's actually $100 million of land sales. A lot of that was acquired by the state government for developments around the airport. That's in it as well. So really the operating surplus as far as our day-to-day management of the university represents less than half of the bottom line figure that's been reported. And there are really two elements that are the drivers of that. Before I started at the university, my predecessor and the leadership team budgeted in anticipation of a very significant downturn, particularly in international students. So there was cost cutting, there was a voluntary redundancy scheme. The appropriately prudent fiscal measures were put in place given the level of uncertainty that COVID brought to the higher education sector and given the minimum financial support that came to the sector from particularly the federal government. So they budgeted sensibly and wisely. Now, very fortuitously, not only did those significant downturns not occur, we actually had an increase at the University of Sydney in our anticipated numbers of international students, and we had strong growth, particularly out of China. That is a tribute, I think, to our brand, the reputation of the international courses that we run or the services we're providing to international students, and the fact that in the midst of a downturn, we held on to that very, very important international student base, I think is a tribute to the university. So the downturn didn't come. In fact, we survived quite well. We had strong, prudent financial management in place, and so we got a strong result. And we'll be taking that operational result and we'll be investing it in the university in the infrastructure and maintenance, some of which was deferred. We appreciate we need to put on more staff. We have an industrial negotiation underway and we'll need to come with a financial settlement. But one of the things we do know, it's still a very uncertain environment. We still have a lot of COVID in our midst at the university. About two-thirds of our international students are still offshore. The whole dynamic with our largest market, China, remains very much unknown. And so whilst we've done well, we do need to be wise, we do need to be prudent. It's still very uncertain.
And the external...
And so that's the engagement.
The external investment environment is also changing. And so, you know, 2023-24, I suspect, could be, you know, our investments could take quite a hit as well. So,
well, that's the upside and the downside, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly, really? Yeah.
And those are investments that we're holding for the long term. It's not as though your superannuation goes up and you immediately cash it in and spend it. That's not the idea. It's providing you with a buffer through all parts of that investment cycle. And just as the markets boomed last year, it's a lot tougher this year. And so you've just got to hold true. So, you know, the bottom line, well, the headline figure that some newspapers have seized on is not actually the reality. I don't suggest for a moment it's not a good result achieved by hard work by our staff and strong commitment by our students. It's a good result. It's a one-off result. We're not going to see anything like it again for a considerable period of time. And we need to be prudent with what we do with that result, given the very uncertain operating environment that we're in.
Mark, we've talked about the big political issues of the moment, and we've talked about your involvement in politics more generally. I wanted to, and education, I want to drill down now into a few things that relate to journalism and where that's at currently. You were director of the ABC for 10 years. Where do you see journalism currently, given that we've seen this election result with such a fragmented result, and it seems to reflect what we see in the journalistic world as well?
Yeah, there's no doubt this is a real challenge, I think, for media outlets. I wrote a little book about this a couple of years ago called On Us, and it was reflecting on my 10 years at the ABC. And over that decade, you really did see the breakdown of broad media markets, mass media markets, where really all parts of Australia came together to watch the ABC or commercial television news or read a handful of newspapers, into a far greater fragmentation of the media market. And you can see that people are now in a position to choose the media outlets that reflect and reinforce the views that they have. And social media amplifies that reinforcing environment. So it's very hard for politicians, I think, to communicate a broad message outside these bubbles, these ecosystems that have emerged in a fragmented media market. And it's very challenging for media outlets like the ABC that are attempting to be as broad and inclusive as they can be, in a sense, when the market has become that much more fragmented around them. I mean, I do think an interesting story of this campaign will be the impact of News Corporation papers. I do subscribe to the view, having studied them closely over the years, that they were that much more aggressive and partisan around who they were cheering and who they were attacking than we'd ever seen before. That would be my assessment. They really, you know, I think their attacks on the Teal Independents and others seem to be very, very strong. But did it make a difference? Is there evidence that they were persuading audiences and moving votes. I think that's not what the results show. And so, again, I think it's a tough, fragmented environment, and the business model around journalism remains very, very tough. Quality journalism was always subsidised. It was either subsidised by government for something like the ABC or by advertising, particularly classified advertising, for our quality newspaper market. Those advertising subsidies are harder to get now, given the audience is that much more fragmented and advertisers have more choice. And so it's difficult to make the investment. When I was editor-in-chief at Fairfax, I think we had 500 journalists working across 7 days at Fairfax in Sydney. I reckon it would be fewer than 150 now. And that just is that much harder to get the time and investment of journalistic resource around big stories the way that it once happened.
Yeah, I think it'd be really hard to be a journalist now. I mean, it's a long time since I've been in front of a microphone on radio journalism, but I just think it would be so difficult. And of course, we all have journalism schools at our universities. So how do you go about then training? I mean, we're going off script a bit, but it's an interesting discussion about, you know, training our journalists for this environment that they're in, because, you know, the senior journalists that you and I know, Ron, you know, they are bemoaning the good old days. And I don't think it's just that they're senior people and we all bemoan the good old days. When you had time to actually reflect and think and get a message across, you just don't. And I know you still Channel 7 now.
Many journalists now are filing 3-4 times a day.
Yeah.
So the idea of sitting back and then thinking about what you want to write in this piece to sort of consider everything is almost impossible. Mm. So, Margaret, at a time when, you know, there's a fragmented audience, as we've seen with the election, it's very, very hard then to give them the information in the most profound way.
Yeah, look, I think that's right. I think it's a high-volume game now for many. And the other thing that I think is very different back in my day, you'd edit an edition of the Herald, you'd put it out, you'd get some information in a day or two on how many newsstand sales you'd had, but that was about all the feedback you got. You'd look at, you know, what stories generated letters, what stories other media picked up on. Now, as stories are published online, editors have immediate insight into which stories people are interested in, which they aren't, and you're that much more likely, and they are that much more likely to then commission more stories about the stories that are driving immediate traffic, and it becomes this kind of narrowing and self-reinforcing a narrower range of stories that are being covered. Whereas often I think the most significant stories that would have been written in newspapers a decade or two ago may not have generated immediate huge traffic, but they were of long and lingering importance and impact. And it's harder to do that kind of journalism. And as you said, it's harder for journalists to have the time to do the deep research that's really required in order to get great journalism, particularly great investigative journalism, done. And that's why I do believe a well-funded, independent ABC is absolutely vital to the workings of democracy in this country, to the service of justice, for deep quality investigative journalism. And it's vital. And I am hopeful that the incoming government supports and respects the work of the public broadcaster as a vital pillar in our democracy here, and supports the ABC as a result of that conviction.
It also reinforces our role as universities in providing that solid evidence base and that deep research that you talked about, Mark, and being part of the solution. Because in many ways you almost have to bypass media because it is such a crowded environment and you're not getting your message across. And so, you know, we have to stay true to what we do, and that is the evidence base and providing that to government in a way that's, you know, digestible and provide solutions for government. So I think there is, you know, there is an interrelationship between what we do in that space and the public commentary space, which is really important.
So one last question to you though, Mark. If you put your ABC cap on from many years ago, and you were watching a result like this, how would you feel as managing director as the Albanese government comes in? Would you feel that there's the likelihood of more money for the ABC?
You know, I think what you'd want to do is to be constructively engaged with the government. I think you recognise that the government's going to be under enormous fiscal pressure. The governments have been spending so much money in recent years. I think we haven't quite got our head around that. Massive deficit budgets will need to be hauled in and become surplus budgets over time. that debt will need to be arrested and turned around. And so therefore any call on the public purse will be strongly scrutinised. And I think, you know, in my experience, and I was managing director under Labor governments and coalition governments, governments of all colours can be critical and combative with the ABC. I think history shows that as well. But I do think, again, for the ABC, like the higher education sector, it's an opportunity of a reset. It's an opportunity of a respectful engagement. And I think the ABC has a great story to tell about the unique role it plays in Australia, its unique service to Australian communities, and why it needs to be well supported into the future.
Mark Scott, thank you so very much for your insights today. It's been a fascinating discussion about so many different topics. Thank you for your time today. Thanks for your company today. If you'd like more information about the issues raised in this podcast or other related topics, please visit our website at go8.edu.au. And a quick reminder that you can always tune into the debate at Go8 on Spotify, Google, Apple, or YouTube. Bye for now.